All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Bruce. Welcome, everyone, to the House of the Rising Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And thank you so much, Joan, once again, for a lovely reading of the text and the lesson. And next week, we will be on ACIM Gather for A Course in Miracles starting on September 1st. Every morning now, we'll be doing the text and the lesson, Joan will, on ACIM Gather for A Course in Miracles. And Awakening Together will not be open at all on Saturdays. So Friday and Saturday, no Awakening Together. It's all ACIM Gather. And then the rest of the schedule is in a posting on Awakening Together. So hopefully you all get to see it. And so, Bruce, what do you got for us this morning? I bet you sent me something. I haven't even looked at it yet. Let me know.
Well, actually, last week we
did right.
FAQ 1204, but we didn't get to 1206, and I was rereading that this morning. It's like, wow, there's some good stuff in there. So I was thinking, that would be a good one to do. So
okay.
I put the link in the chat window. So.
All righty.
This is,
we seem to be moving slowly on my side.
FACIM.org. Which is the Foundation for A Course in Miracles organization website. And if you go to the online training materials and then click on the frequently asked questions, you will get to it and you'll discover they have a completely separate website, which is fully makes sense because there's a lot there. There's over 1,300 questions, and we're getting close to the end at 1206. But if you can go through them either in numerical, which is also chronological order, the order in which they were added to the site, or you can use the search function and search for different topics, and there's just a huge assortment of just everyday questions that people have that relate to, you know, very practical understanding and implementation of A Course in Miracles. And then there's by topic. So there's by topic, by FAQ, by search, by just typing in a topic. And then there's also the numerical chronological index. So lots of different ways to get at this excellent body of work. So,
outstanding. Could you shoot me that link again? Because for some reason it's not showing up.
Sure, you betcha. Yeah, I think it may have come into the other account that you sent. I know you do two of them to get this recording going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. So.
Did you get it?
I got it. So
great. Okay.
I'll tap in there and paste and whoop. It says missed group call. So I must have caught the wrong thing here. Let me try this again.
Okay. The full URL.
Oh, there we go.
FACIM.reach.org/QA/questions/questions255.htm and then pound symbol Q1206 for question 1206.
I got it.
Yep.
All right, and I'm going to paste that in the room here so people can go there and check it out as well. Mm-hmm. And something I do want to also mention, Bruce, is that, you know, there are numerous people who are doing fundraisers for the foundation.
Uh-huh.
And one of those people is our new collaborator, Tony Ponticello from the Community Miracle Center in San Francisco. And we're doing a fundraiser in September, actually, I believe it is.
Oh, great.
Let me check that out, and I'll get you the info on that.
Okay.
Because one of the things that Tony was mentioning yesterday was wondering if they were going to be given any kind of press through the foundation. And I said, well, you know, I would think that the foundation would. So we'll see, you know, maybe, I don't know. There's that. And then also David Hoffmeister, I know, is doing one next year in Utah, a fundraiser for them as well.
Right.
So,
I wasn't aware of this, the September one, so I will pass that along. And I suspect that they probably already have things in the works. And
Bob and Tamara are going to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think I'm pretty sure it's known, but, you know, the more people who know, the obviously.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I will get the word out and double check on from the connections I have and go from there. Yeah.
Cool. Great. Very good.
Thank you, Matt.
All right. So let us move on. Do you want to start with? I'll start by reading the question. How about that?
Perfect.
All right. So we're on question 1206 on the FACIMOutreach.org questions and answers. Okay. So what I have learned so far in studying A Course in Miracles is that there is no real love in this world. And that's a sad thing if you think about it, but it really, no. And that forgiveness cannot change anything in the world, only our perception of it. We can then look on devastation and know it is false, but we would still be, quote unquote, seeing the devastation, correct? How does that work? In the crucifixion, for example, was Jesus, as the observer, watching it all happen, as the apostles later reported, quote unquote, seeing it, while at the same time untouched by it? No fear, no pain. Whoa, there's here. This is it. I mean, this is really the question that no matter what other question people ask in A Course in Miracles, you know, how did it all happen? Who? What was Tiny Matt's idea? Blah blah blah. This one of love, forgiveness, and suffering is probably the one that most everybody needs to know or understand.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't understand this, then you will continue to believe that suffering is necessary and purposeful. You will continue to believe that there's love in this world, and you will then continually forget to forgive these situations that come up to you, and therefore you will continue in the cycle of suffering, lack of love, and guilt, basically around and around and around. So, you know, this question, and it, this ties into, and I haven't read ahead on the question, so it may or may not, but in my mind, this ties into the entire discussion of the script is written.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that the script was written long ago. It happened. Everything that appears to be happening now actually happened long ago, and all we're doing is observing it.
Exactly.
And if we could understand that, then we would declare everyone in the world innocent, and forgiveness would be complete.
Yeah.
Seriously.
No, that's completely right on the mark. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I, as you were mentioning that, it occurs to me that there's a number of different topics that all tie into it, both things we've talked about as well as other general subjects that are addressed by A Course in Miracles, and how they're all interconnected, how each of these questions in the FAQ series, all of which to me are gems, all really, in a sense, kind of tying into what you were saying, are asking the same question. They're all part of the same body of understanding, which isn't a body, but we use that word in our language, but it's the same pool, oceanic, but it's the same stuff. It's the fact that it's holographic. It's really a reminder that it's all one awareness, and that's the awareness of non-duality that we never left, that is the essence of what we are, that is the awareness from which our decision-making mind chooses either what we call Holy Spirit, or sometimes inner kindness teacher, as I like to call that understanding, or the Jesus of A Course in Miracles symbolically, or we choose the insanity of the ego's thought system, which tries to make love about specifics in the world. And that's where the whole, you know, subject of special love and special hate, and how we need to go beyond both of those, ties into this question quite well, I think. And all the things you were just addressing as well, because they're all part of the same thing. You know, the whole question about forgiveness and, you know, our attempts to make the world work for us. And the only way it really works is by recognizing that, it's a hallucination. That's a result of projected unconscious guilt, and then it ties into another vast subject, which is the resistance that we have to being aware of that consistently, and then forgiving ourselves for that resistance. So anyway, it covers a lot of ground, huh?
It does cover a lot of ground, but it really comes to the very first miracle principle, which is there is no order of difficulty in miracles.
Right.
All are the same completely, and all expressions of love are maximal.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another thing. If all expressions of love are maximal, even if we don't know what love is, but even we're just attempting to be loving, that is a maximal expression.
Right.
You know, we may not know what we're doing, but it is a maximal expression of love because it's from a son of God. You can't help but be maximally loving. Yeah. But we just don't see it because it doesn't appear in this illusion. So, so you know, you go right back down to that. When you come to understand that there is no order of difficulty in miracles and that all expressions of love are maximal, that's the whole course. It's everything you need to know. But yeah. To come to know that, you need the whole course. So, I'll let you read the
And the whole course is contained in every seeming little part of it. As you were speaking, I was thinking of another metaphor that crossed my mind that I think is really helpful, is that, you know, we're the individuals that we think we are like droplets in the ocean that are still in the ocean, but we believe because of this elaborate hoax that we call space-time and bodies and individuality, we believe that we've actually been able to carve out little separate identities that seem to be unique and distinct and separate from each other. And in fact, we've gotten to the sophistication and the elaborate production value, if you think of it in terms of a video, where not only the special effects very convincing, but we even thoroughly believe that we are just these separate identities and we're not each other, and that we're not the totality of all it is, because of the convincing costume that we call our bodies and the personas that made it up. It's like, wow, what an elaborate hoax. But like these little droplets, you know, I think the attempts to experience love, oftentimes the ones that seem most successful to me are the ones where we are willing to suspend the belief in the ego just for a split second or a few moments. Then that oceanic awareness comes flooding in, just like if you take your finger and, you know, make a little depression in the ocean, leaning over the edge of a boat, that if you lift your finger out of where you've made that depression, the water comes flooding back, you know, to fill that hole immediately. It doesn't say, well, let's you know, have a committee meeting and decide whether or not to, you know, let's table that for now. No, it's immediate. It's just, but I think that's what happens. The instant we let go of our ego and let go of the John Wayne, I'm going to do it myself, thinking, that feeling of peace comes flooding back in, and the innocence and the complete release from the torment of ego's insanity is we have an immediate benefit from it. And it's also a cumulative benefit, because the more we do that, the more we realize, wow, my strategy, my little separate strategy that I, you know, call ego, has not worked for me at all. And the more I suspend that, even if it's just for a little moment here and there, the more peaceful I seem to be during the course of the day. And that's the motivation that our inner kindness teacher uses to get us to look at how insane it is to try to find peace where we're never going to find it, which is what this question addresses very nicely. So shall I read the first paragraph?
Yes, please do.
Okay. Yes, you are correct about there being no real love in this world. The reason is that this world was made by our minds and remains in our minds, since ideas leave not their source, to cover the guilt we felt over having destroyed the love of God. Of course, the love of God cannot be destroyed, but we believed we did it and now are dealing with the consequences of that belief. But we always retain in our minds the memory of our true identity as one with God. That oceanic awareness again, huh? to use that metaphor. And by choosing to have Jesus be our teacher and model, we can learn to be reflections of that love by undoing all the barriers we have built to hide it. Barriers made of judgment, specialness, hatred, and the wish to be separate. But the love is in our minds, not the world. Wow. And that's I think that last sentence really sums it up nicely, is the real love, which is what we're all wanting to return to, has never left our mind. We just left our mind. we've been literally
out of our minds.
We're out of our minds, yeah. We're out of our real minds, and that's what A Course in Miracles and any other pure non-dual teaching is reminding us, that we've never left it. But the world is by default, you know, if we use the ego's, you know, default purpose, you know, just out of the box without toggling the setting, you know, believe the interpretations that this is the real world is the default setting that this elaborate hologram comes with. If we don't uncheck that box, we believe it. Yeah, we think, well, gosh, I have these biological things called parents that tell me that there's a biological thing called a person, and I'm it, and I'm not in all these other things, and so the ocean has been divided into the haves and the have-nots. I have this body and you don't have this body, and I have this history and you don't have this history, and we all can say, make the same fraudulent claim on our division of the universe. And it's just kind of silly, isn't it? I mean, when you think about it, how thoroughly we've indoctrinated ourselves. But we can just as thoroughly, while we're using all the normal common sense things to navigate the world, it doesn't mean we abandon that learning. We just learn to not identify with it and to see that our identification with it is where all the pain has come from, whether it's psychological, which I really love how Gary Renard's teachers just say, well, all pain is psychological. It's just, yeah. It's because we think that our bodies are real, that we think that there's physical pain, and so we have an elaborate system that seems, again, very convincing, with special effects that rival and surpass anything that the world's special effects and post-production studios can come up with. It's just phenomenally convincing.
Go ahead.
Like Chip and Dale. Well, I'll finish the thought, and then if you can remember yours, the special effects is like it's so convincing because we think it's real, and so it's, you know, reinforces our belief, and that was it, but basically.
Yep. So what I was going to say is that it's easy, actually, for us to fool ourselves because we make up the criteria. We're the ones that say what is real and what is not.
Yeah.
So we're making up the criteria for reality. So it's really easy to satisfy that criteria and make sure that it doesn't, that nothing in our experience goes outside of that criteria. And therefore it appears to be real to us. And, you know, if you are living in that place where you think it's all real, then, it all seems to make sense and it matches. And it's just these little whispers that come into our mind that say, you know, there's something more and, you know, what about God? And, you know, what about, you know, you just start getting reminders that there's, there's more to us than what appears. And, the thing that is so compelling to me, and this is probably going to be one of my major teachings that I'm doing within the next couple of years. In fact, I'm actually writing a book about it, is this use of guilt, the ego's use of guilt to actually build and maintain the structure of the illusion, and how easily we fall into this guilt. And we buy into it because, of course, we think we're guilty. And so, you know, so it's really easy then for ego to show us, oh, look, here are the flowers that your husband brought you home, you know, last week. And wasn't that wonderful? But look at, they're all wilted. What did you do wrong that you've allowed this guilt, this love to die? And that's symbolic enough to set up a whole, even though you're not, obviously I'm not responsible because those flowers died, because they were cut from their stems and they were no longer attached to their source. And even if they were still going to die, fade, die, turn into seeds or something. So they were never going to stay the same thing that they are. But now I'm blaming myself because, you know, this was a symbol of love. And now it's turned into a bunch of, you know, rotting, drooping flowers that I'm going to throw in the trash. I'm going to throw them in the garbage. So
or green waste, if you have green waste, right?
Right, or something like that. Yeah, yeah. You must live in California
for a few more weeks.
But that's it. See, it's this whole. It doesn't matter what it is. I'm going to feel guilty about it. If, you know, yesterday we went out to the state fair. And that's a privilege of living in Pueblo, is because we have the state fair here. And so it's, you know, some entertainment. And, you know, we took the baby out there and, you know, we walked around. He's little, so he was highly entertained by everything. But then we walked into this building, which was for, hang on just a second. Yes, come in. Yeah, I'm busy. I'll come and see you in a minute. Are you sick?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll come see you in a minute. That's my granddaughter. So she's fine. Don't worry. Anyway, we walked into this building where they had all the swine, the goats, and the sheep, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, you're thinking you're like walking into the petting zoo or something. Swine and goat, and you know, we're going to see these cool animals. And, of course, we go in there, and all these animals are in cages, and they're all getting set up to be judged. And then, you know, when they're judged, the ones that are, you know, really good are going to get sold for a high price. And then it's going to be, you know, bacon or lamb chops or something. And the place just, you know, stunk like, you know, a barnyard, only enclosed. And, and there were all these people in there, like, you know, the people that obviously raised the animals or took care of the animals, and they're all standing around being very nonchalant. And I just looked at these animals in these little cages, and I thought, you know, my God, you know, there's all there's, you know, they're seeing, you know, obviously the animal that they raised and tended and cleaned and fed and took care of for all these many months, or, you know, however long they had them. This is a creature that they've established a relationship with, and now they've brought this creature to this fair to be shown off, judged, and then, you know, killed and eaten. And, you know, and they're all just happy as clams. And I mean, obviously, you know, being the mind of Lynn, which is filled with ego thoughts, you know, I was just running rampant. You know, my mind was just running rampant with, you know, look at these idiots. They don't even recognize what they're doing here. And look at these poor animals and, you know, what, you know, terrible suffering. And this just exactly what this question is asking. You know, here's the answer right here. As long as you're thinking with the ego, you're going to see guilt. You're going to assign guilt. You're going to be judge, jury, and executioner. And in reality, nothing is happening. You know, there really are no pigs. There really are no sheep. There really is no, you know, barnyard in, you know, the Pueblo Fairgrounds. And these are all stories that I'm making up to reassure me that I am definitely guilty and definitely worthy of living in this suffering veil of tears. So, and in me, you know, I just walked out of there with just this, it was really a mixed feeling, because I did have the concept of forgiveness in my mind, and I did have the Holy Spirit to ask about these things, you know, my inner kindness teacher, as you call him. I did have all of that. And yet I still found myself, you know, looking at these people and not seeing the Christ. I was just seeing a bunch of, you know, slack-jawed yokels with let's kill this hog so I can get my money kind of thing in my mind. That's how I was assigning to them. You know, I was turning them into not sons of God at all, but just these ego figurines out there in the world. And it really gave me a lot to think about. I'm still thinking about it. How quickly I moved to judgment and how quickly I moved to condemn. Uh-huh. And yet, you know, I've been studying this course for, 14 years. So it is not a simple thing. I know you've got something to say, so please.
Oh, I think you gave me a great example, and thank you for that, because that really, highlights how we, just first of all, the nature of projection, how we always, make the error outside ourselves instead of realizing, well, this is anything that we see is a projection of our unconscious mind, and if they're really, if modern physics and ancient mysticism and A Course in Miracles are correct, which all lead to the same inevitable conclusion, is that there's no out there, as physicist John Wheeler says, then the animals that you saw and the humans that were their, owners / caretakers / marketers, are no different than any part of our egoic mind. Whether it's a grocer selling a head of broccoli or a little package of mung sprouts or alfalfa sprouts, or if it's a car dealer selling a bunch of minerals that have been fashioned into something that has wheels and an engine and seems to take a body from one place to another place and uses fossil fuels or stored
burned oil that's coming from an Indian reservation where they're
it's all right. Exactly, the pipelines and not in fracking, and you get into the whole thing of it's just this seemingly hopeless quagmire of thoughts about how to fix the world. Yeah. and obviously the compassion, whether it's, toward the animals or the people at a state or county fair or the people involved in what appear to be, both sides or multiple sides of controversies around environmental issues of oil extraction or the grocery business and shipping, things that we pull out of the earth and consume and then become fertilizer. do you just follow the whole cycle? What's that?
It goes on and on and on and on.
It does. And that's where we need to, just put our hands together. I'm doing this little, virtual T with my hands, the timeout symbol, right? and I think that's what our inner kindness teacher does every moment, is basically say, wait a minute. It doesn't have to mean we stop what we're doing or even what we're saying, but to just look at what we're thinking about everything and say, I could see peace instead of this. I could see an alternative where all the people involved in whether you're at a state or county fair or at your everyday workplace or driving down the freeway or talking to, in my case yesterday, some family that's visiting. And I have a little story to share in a moment about that. It's all the same. And it's, I think it's so helpful to remember that when we start getting into, what's in it for me and making it all about, what we get out of anything, that's when we're back to, the impossible dream of making the whole space-time dream work. On the ego's terms, but it can work beautifully on the Holy Spirit's terms by using it for a different purpose. And that purpose, of course, is to see everything as an opportunity to express kindness and shared interests and to see, the opportunity to dissolve in our mind the belief in separation. And then that creates a resonance or, or a, you know, a window or a maybe a depression in the ocean of ego's ocean, if you will, that to where the love can come in to fill the gap that we've made by suspending the ego for just that little moment.
Yeah. Where go ahead. It's just this weird to me because it's like my whole family does this. You know, my family are ranchers and farmers.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So my nieces and nephews all grew up raising these animals, doing.
Sure.
I mean, it was them. This was
sure.
my family.
Right.
These were my brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
And you know, I was not seeing, it that way. So
yeah.
So I
have cousins that lived on a ranch, and we'd go out there, and I'd help my cousin Bill change the irrigation pipes and get up to past our knees in mud, and I thought it was fun, actually, but he thought it was a job, so it's because he had to do it every day. That was his job. So moving the irrigation pipes in the orchards, but and then slaughtering the, you know, he actually named one of his cows, and then he realized when he was eating it for dinner one evening, he's like, well, what? Why did I name my cow?
Hey,
you know, that kind of thing, you know. So, but it's that whole thing is, you know, it's the belief that somehow we have damaged perfect oneness, that guilt is justified, and that it's possible for the perfection and the perfect innocence that we all are and share could have been tainted or diluted or in any way compromised. But that's the whole strategy of the ego, and that's why we've made up this elaborate thing that involves some people having careers as ranchers and farmers and shippers of those products, and other people as grocers, and other people as consumers. Well, pretty much everyone, that take on other jobs and different roles and do different things in our society that seem like they're, you know, and we make such big deals out of the differences, forgetting that it's the sameness that leads us out of the mirage, out of the matrix of people's mind trap. And the Course in Miracles reminds us wonderfully that it may seem like a, you know, intractable, impossible problem that the ego set up, but you know, maybe foolproof when we're identifying with the foolishness of the ego, but it's not God-proof. Because sooner or later we're going to recognize the upset and the trauma and the craziness of ego's strategy just isn't working for us, and choose against it. I mean, it's inevitable. It's just, it's really always a matter of when, not if.
Exactly.
That we choose against the ego, and that's where the hope lies.
And that is exactly where the hope lies. And it can be done at any time.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's so amazing. It isn't something that is far distant in the future. It is something that is right this very moment, right here and right now. And it's a choice. And you know, it's a choice. You know, I partially made that choice while I was at the fair because I recognized what I was doing and I asked for help. But you know, the layers are so deep that it's not like it just goes away when you look at the surface and say, I wish I didn't feel bad for these animals, or, you know, I wish I didn't hate all these people, or I wish I was, I wish whatever it is that you would rather have be happening other than what appears to be happening. You know, anytime you have a protest against that, that's ego. Ego says, no, I don't like this. No, this is not right. No, you know, ego is the one who says no about everything.
Right.
Where if you just listen to Jesus and he says, you know, just let things be as they are. Just don't try to change the world. You know, recognize that everything is perfect and then look for that perfection rather than looking for the fault, and rather than judging it as being something unworthy or wrong or bad or evil or even wonderful and joyful. You know, that's mm-hmm. the other thing, too. We go one way with our judgment and condemn that, but we don't go with the whole way with our judgment and say, you know, why do I like this? Why is this, you know, what is it that is, you know, making, you know, this ice cream that I'm eating better than, you know, any other thing or whatever. It's all because you have an opinion about things and you think one thing is better than another. And, you know, the healed mind knows that there's no difference. And, you know, that, and that's, you know, one of the reasons you want the mind to heal so that you're no longer caught up in these judgments to the point where you're not able to see clearly that my interest and yours are not different. And that's really the point, is to come to the place where we all recognize that our interests are all the same. We are the same, and that oneness is what we share. But anyway, let's see. Did you read, and then is it my turn to read?
Yeah, I just had a quick commentary before we go on. It was kind of ties in what you're talking about, the special love, special hate subject. And also kind of allowing, you know, oneself to be guided, you know, by, and sometimes it takes specific forms. And yesterday I think I felt like I was able to kind of get my interests out of the way enough, because I've had family here visiting for a few days, and my aunt and uncle and brother, and I've been living here with my mother for almost a year, and just about to wrap that up. So it was a multiple family visit, and during the course of the conversations a couple days ago, my aunt was talking about how they had visited a place called the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, Russia. And it's this incredibly elaborate museum with all these amazing artifacts and just, you know, just the opulence essentially of the Tsar regime, if you will, or the reign of that group of people in that epoch of history. And synchronistically, I was putting together a post for Rocky Mountain Miracle Center, because they have a movie of the month. And the movie that the fellow who puts these together, that he chose, was called Russian Ark. And I hadn't heard of this movie, and I watched the previews while I was putting the post on the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center website together. And I thought, wow, this looks kind of interesting. And I had some things in my mind I thought would be kind of fun to share. But then I realized, well, okay, what if I make it about them? What if I make it about my aunt and uncle and my mom, who was also interested, and my brother, who likes world travel, so I suggested, well, hey, maybe we could watch this documentary. And it's a very unique film. It was actually done all in one take, which is amazing, because it's all like about a 2-hour film. That, you know, it wasn't any, a whole bunch of scenes spliced together. It was literally one 2-hour take. It was just one continuous scene where the camera on a Steadicam moves through this elaborate complex a museum on steroids, basically, with all of these amazing art treasures. But it wasn't just a static, empty museum kind of a thing. What the movie did is they populated it with people from all these different eras over the last couple hundred years. That in full, incredibly elaborate costume, doing the things that may have taken place during that time. And so I was really grateful that Charles had suggested this, because everybody seemed to like it when we watched it yesterday on Netflix. But what was going through my head, in addition to just watching the elaborate links that each artist had made with every little detail, not just the artwork on the walls, but the costumes and the choreography, and with several orchestras that were in each of these grand ballrooms and the dances and several of them, and the other conversations that people had that were historical figures and that were reenacted. It was just amazing to see the lengths to which we go through to make something that seems real, and to do it with a continuity, you know, the single take. So we don't see that it's a movie. And the metaphor didn't escape me at several points in the film, when some of the dialogue even reinforced the surreality of this world by demonstrating the surreality of the movie, which is, I recommend it if you haven't seen it. It's called Russian Ark. Anyway, so, but the other thing that was kind of interesting was, rather than, you know, kind of insisting or pressuring my other family members to watch something that I usually watch. It's like, well, gee, maybe I could try something that might be of interest because they brought it up. And everybody seemed to enjoy it. And I think that's how it often works, is when we get our personal interests out of the way, and turn it around to like, well, what's the shared interest here? Even on a pragmatic level, oftentimes that works to where, you know, we were able to undo, you know, any of the, problems. You know, we all had a really good time basically. Yeah. Cause we didn't, you know, let the separate interests become uppermost while we were enjoying the film together. And anyway, so that seemed like a good example of, you know, getting the separate interests out of the way. So.
That's pretty cool. And I think I'm going to watch that movie too. So it seems really interesting. Thank you for bringing it up, because, you know, I love that kind of stuff.
And they're going to air that at the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center on the 11th of September in the afternoon, if anybody wants to in the Denver area, go watch it. So, yeah.
How very cool that is.
Yeah.
I love it. All right. So I'm going to go on to the next. Let's see. What did I do? All right. The next paragraph or the next. Yeah. So again, back to the question is about seeing devastation and suffering in the world and fear, pain, all these different things. And they also ask about Jesus when he was on the cross, what was his state of mind? And he pretty much reports in The Course in Miracles that his state of mind was that he was really just observing. It wasn't really, and because, you know, he was already master of the illusion, basically, you know, he was actually he knew his body was illusion, that, you know, nothing could really actually harm it. Because it is just, you know, nothing. So I'm going to go to the next paragraph. In your second point, you appear to be referring to one of the Course's definitions of the miracle, which emphasizes its role as a correction. Quote, it does not create nor really change at all. It merely looks on devastation and reminds the mind that what it sees is false. And that is in the workbook, part two. I don't know. I really understand how these particular,
that might be a typo because it says 13, but
I know,
I know workbook lesson 13 is not in part two. So
no,
that may be a typo there.
Okay. That's what I'm thinking. Cause you know, I never saw lesson 13 in part two of the workbook.
Yeah. So. There are not many typos, but that may be one of them. So.
It could be. Or, you know, yeah, but it's repeated, so I'll have to check that out. Jesus then speaks of forgiveness as the home of miracles. Therefore, it does not change anything in the world, only the perceptions in our mind. Remember, there is no world. This is from lesson 132. This is the central thought the Course attempts to teach. So Jesus would not be teaching us how to change things in the world when he knows there is no world. But since we believe there is a world, he helps us see that it is but a projection of our own minds, and that we give it all the meaning it has, and that is what he wants us to focus on. The world, quote, is the witness to your state of mind, the outside picture of an inward condition. Therefore, seek not to change the world, but choose to change your mind about the world. And that is also from text 21. And these are really famous, in my mind, famous quotes. These are the things that really hit home that Jesus is saying. Really, seriously, there's no world. Really, seriously. You know, whatever you're trying to do here, you're messing with nothing. You're trying to, fill the hole that's left when you pull your finger out of the ocean. It just is not, as you were referring to earlier, is, it's not necessary or possible. So we first accept the ego or Jesus as our teacher. Then our perception or interpretation of what our eyes see reflects that choice. And then another quote from the Course, perception seems to teach you what you see, yet it but witnesses to what you taught. It is the outward picture of a wish. an image that you wanted to be true. And that's from text chapter 24. So really what Jesus is saying is that what we see is what we want to see. You know, I walked into that barnyard wanting to see devastation.
Mm-hmm.
I walked into that barnyard wanting to see, people at their worst. And you know, reflecting back, you know, it just was a lot of people having a good time, and they were all happy to be at the fair. And, it was probably, you know, because I know when you live out on a farm and stuff, and you're not so connected, and you don't get to go into, you know, things like the fair all the time. It's a big party. It's a joyful thing to do. And here I'm choosing to see ignorance and heathenry instead of, you know, joy and just goodness. You know, I was choosing to see something. So this what he's talking about, this miracle, is not me running through the thing saying, "You all should be vegetarians. Why are you eating these poor animals? Set them free, set them free." Or, you know, I mean, seriously, the miracle is not that. The miracle is, you know, me looking at that and saying, really, honestly, everyone is here thinking that they're doing something that they want to do. Even these creatures who are here for that very purpose. They're not different or separate from me in any way at all. And even imagining that they're different and separate from me is the reason that I'm in pain about it, that I'm upset about it, mm-hmm. is because I'm perceiving it as something outside of myself. That is pointing to my own guilt. Right. Is saying, look, you, Lynn, you're not doing anything about this. And look, these animals are suffering. And look, these people are ignorant. You're not doing anything to change this. Which, again, is why half the people I have friends on Facebook are posting, you know, don't eat animals and look at how mean you are. And look at what a terrible person you are that you're letting these things go on. It's just all guilt. That is just meant to keep me believing that suffering is true and real, and it's insanity.
It is. And the story you just related about the fair and the animals is no different than the story I was sharing about the watching the movie about the Russian czars and the opulence that went in the, you know, the incredible efforts and probably sacrifices that went into putting all those things together in a different context for this vast museum of amazing art, and this, whether special love or special hate, you know, it doesn't matter, because anything that makes the difference is important, whether it's the royalty and the opulence, or the difference of the poverty and of you know, people who are just barely getting by making a subsistence living with, you know, raising animals, or maybe doing really well at it, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, that all the differences that we make such a big deal out of, really are, examples of nothing happening. But it's the kindnesses that we show each other. You know, the moments where the people at the state fair, shared a laugh and not at anyone else's expense. And the same with in the movie that I watched of the Russian history reenacted it over several hundred years in this massive, complex called the Hermitage, you know, and one of the, you know, it's no different. There's no difference between the forms, but the content in the mind is what's different, and that's what I think the central thought the Course attempts to teach is that the world is not what's important, but it's the choice in the mind of the teacher that we use to interpret the world with it is makes all the difference. Shall I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Your eyes could be looking at the twisted wreckage of cars and bodies on the highway, for example, but your perception / interpretation of this event would depend on whether you have chosen the ego or Jesus as your teacher. If you are perceiving with Jesus, your inner peace would not be affected by the outer offense. which does not mean, however, that you might not stop and offer assistance if you could. We're talking only about the content in your mind, not behavior. The ego's interpretation would always center on victims and victimizers, tragedy, loss, fear, anxiety, anything that would support the reality of separate bodies, vulnerable to outside forces and conditions. Whether it's the czars or their subjects in Russia over the last couple hundred years, or whether it's the farmers or the pigs or the goats or the sheep, the cattle. I mean, it's all the same. And it's all a matter of, do we interpret the world that we see at any given moment as a tragedy or as a classroom? And is it a prison or is it a classroom in which we look at the opportunities to see things differently? And then it says, making their peace and happiness depend on these externals. In this context, you might find it helpful to look at questions 1111 and 1187. So it's always about the ego's interpretation, isn't it? What do we buy into that? Do we look at the ego's wanting to paint everything as either black or white and say, well, this person does this, has this behavior, so therefore their mind must be holy or evil, you know, at any given moment. And and yet the idea of evil, sin, wickedness, all that that the ego loves to indulge in and throw the mud at, you know, it's not just the political seasons or election years that this happens. Whenever we take a seeming individual and judge or condemn based on behavior, based on form, we're neglecting the perfection of the spirit that's behind that, that is the same spirit we all share, and forgetting that, you know, we could identify with that. We could see peace instead of this usually being a specific that we've made a special love-hate relationship out of. Do you want to read the next paragraph? Are you still there, Lynn?
Yes, I'm still here. I'm sorry.
Okay. You must have had your mute on.
I had my mute on, and I was getting my granddaughter a glass of water.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, I was wondering if that was going to be factored in. Good.
If you could you read the next paragraph?
And certainly.
I'll run and get her some water, and I'll be right back.
You betcha. Okay. So there's a one at the end that just basically just see other questions, so I won't read that one. But the last paragraph of consequence in this FAQ starts out: Jesus was the perfect manifestation of love. As a totally healed mind, no ego with guilt to be projected, he could not fearfully or angrily experience himself as a crucified body or an unfairly treated victim, as he explains in the message of the crucifixion. And then the reference here is chapter 6 in the text, section 1, and then also chapter 9, section 1, with the sentences referenced. His mind could do only one thing, love. And that's what we're all working toward, isn't it? Is to get to that point where we go past the special love and the special hate, the infatuation and the infinuation phase. I like to make a little pun out of that. Where we insinuate everyone as being guilty instead of ourselves, without a lisp. and that's that really, if we do only one thing, and it's not really even a doing, it's the allowing. The acceptance, the unconditional acceptance of everyone as being that perfect, all-encompassing spirit that we all are, then, and notice the resistance when we don't want to do that and forgive ourselves for that inevitably leads back to that love. That's that awareness that is peaceful beyond anything we could imagine in this world. But that's our destiny, our heritage. We couldn't mess it up if we tried, but we do try sometimes and that's where the resistance is. We just need to look at that and say, I could see peace instead of this. And I'm not upset for the reason I think. I'm upset because I've chosen the wrong teacher, and I can choose again. I can choose the teacher of kindness and of compassion, and the one that recognizes that the spirit is the only identity that we have, and anything else is just a very elaborate hoax with tremendously sophisticated production value. Whether it's, you know, the movie that I watched yesterday with my family of seeing how much effort was put into the Hermitage in St. Petersburg and all the incredible art treasures there, and the elaborate costumes in that movie and the production values and all this, you know, the effort that all the people involved, thousands of people involved, had to go to in the cast alone to make this epic film. And yet it's a tiny microcosm of the epic film that we're starring in, each of us right now, that we call space-time life, and that we call quote-unquote reality. And it's just crazy, isn't it? Okay.
Well, it is crazy, and it takes an elaborate cooperation amongst, I mean, really, everyone has to have this idea, and of course it is one mind, one ego, one mind, and so, you know, everyone is working together to make this happen. And here's the other thing. This is probably going to sound kind of bizarre, but if you've ever thought about it, maybe not. The guilt of leaving people behind when, thinking that, what is going to happen if I, you know, suddenly recognize the reality and the truth of what is and remember who I am? And then what about, you know, my husband, you know, what's he going to do when, you know, I'm suddenly enlightened? I don't think there's much of a risk of that happening, but excuse me, but you do think these things, and also, I hope, you know, so-and-so is such a unworthy teacher that, you know, I hope I get enlightened before they do. In fact, I'm sure I will be enlightened before they are. And then I can go back and say, that's really exaggerated. But there's a thought.
Oh, yeah.
You know, these fears that come into us, thinking, you know, what's going to happen when I stop seeing differences between people?
Right.
When I stop seeing differences in the world.
Yeah, that latter example you gave of you know, that whole comparative competitive thing, you know, what stops that in its tracks when I am mindful enough to remember it is love makes no comparisons. So if I'm comparing or making different or separate in any way, another person, whether it's another, you know, student of A Course in Miracles or another, you know, person who, you know, alleges to want to understand their mind and so forth, or not, it doesn't matter, because we're all of us, everyone, even the people that seem to be engaged in the most heinous behavior and the most insane, crazy making, activities in our world, which oftentimes is ourselves, if we're honest, look at it with the objectivity of the matrix that we've put ourselves in. If we can see that with forgiveness, it's like, wow, everybody's left off, you know, is off the hook with that understanding. And then that ties into the second, the first idea that you were talking about of, well, what if I get home before, you know, and awaken before anyone else? Well, what helps me with that one was when I realize, okay, in truth, if we're already home, then the only foot dragger is me. Everybody else is just, you know, kind of waiting around, you know, like the Maytag repairman is like, okay, well, when is Bruce going to get off this, you know, individuality kick and this ego thing and wake up?
Think about that? I mean, I think about that too, like, oh, you know, waking up and then looking around and everybody else going, finally.
Really? What took you so long? but I think that can help, you know, just to realize it's not dependent on anyone else, you know. It's just the Course says, you know, it's awaiting on our recognition and our decision, not anything else, you know. And it has no contingency. Our peace of mind has no contingency on anything in the dream, anything in the world.
Yes.
And if we think it is, we've fallen into another ego trap again of thinking that there's a specific that is making the non-specific awareness in our mind the pure abstraction of the Holy Spirit, which is perfect love and peace and innocence and all that good stuff that we just get glimpses of, you know, reflections of glimpses of, possible. But it's not only possible, it's impossible for there to be anything else. And that's what's so crazy about our identification with this world, isn't it?
It is. That is. It's such an enigma, and it's so easily. What amazes me is how concentrated and focused I am on this work, and I know that you are too. And as concentrated and focused as I am on this work and have been, and especially running this Awakening Together, ACIM Gather, doing this work, it's a continuous thing going on all day, every day in my life. I'm hearing it, I'm seeing it, I'm thinking it, I'm working with it. And you know what? 99% of the time I'm thinking about something else.
And yet at the same time, don't you also find, Lynn, that when you have those mindful moments and you recognize, oh wow, I've got hung up on the form again, whether it's dealing with the technology of the forum that you so generously donate, you know, much of your time to, a lot of time in your case, or in my case, you know, I'm doing websites for course related folks in a lot of my time, and you know, a day will go by or good portions of one, and when I realize, wow, I've gotten so immersed in the specifics that I've forgotten to, you know, step back and look at the big picture of why am I doing what I'm doing? You know, what's again, who's the teacher? Who's the one who's the one that's in charge of this mind here?
Who's in charge here? Yeah. And it is amazing. So,
do you want to finish off the last part of the paragraph there?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I left off with the final paragraph. Really, is just more of a further reference, but the one that starts out, Jesus was the perfect manifestation of love, and then I finished the next sentence. The next line says, his mind could do only one thing, love. So, if you want to pick up from there,
okay. I'll just.
Do you want to start the paragraph
I'll start
over?
From the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, good idea. Good idea.
So Jesus was the perfect manifestation of love. As a totally healed mind, and that means no ego with guilt to be projected. I love that definition of what a totally healed mind is. No ego with guilt to be projected. So it's you're not identifying with the ego, and you're not seeing guilt at all. That's what a totally healed mind will do. It just doesn't see guilt. All it sees is, ta-da, the Christ. So he could not fearfully or angrily experience himself as a crucified body or an unfairly treated victim. As he explains in, quote, the message of the crucifixion, his mind could only do one thing, love. We are the ones who give form to that love as our fear and needs allow. The problem we have in comprehending this is that we usually try to understand it from our reference point as bodies. But it can never be understood on that level because our perception of ourselves as bodies is itself a choice to separate ourselves from our minds and from the truth. And, you know, I don't want to go into a big tirade about this. But I do have some thoughts about this. As you go along, you know, you hear these things, and this is one of those things. It can never be understood on that level. How do we move into the next level in order to be able to see and understand these things? It is a different level of thinking, and it is a shift that has to happen to move us into that level of thinking. And that's what all these lessons are made to do, is to cause the shift. And little by little by little by little, we get used to having our mind shifted by these lessons. And that's why it's so important that we do them the way that they're given to us to do. Excuse me. And that includes the textual things that come along with them. Like right now we're in these lessons where there are these questions, what is forgiveness, what is sin, you know, and the one that starts tomorrow is what is the world? And the way that the lessons are written is that you actually read that, that what is the world, and contemplate that as you do the lesson of the day. So the lesson of the day is based on that concept of what is forgiveness. And I think what happens is a lot of times we don't even read that, or we just go and do, you know, read the lesson and practice that. But without the context that here's what we're doing this lesson for, is to look at, you know, what forgiveness is, or like tomorrow starts, what is the world? That's huge to do the lesson from the point of view of what is the world. It shifts your mind, and that's the reason this course is written the way it is. And starting January 1 on ACIM Gather, I will be doing extensive daily workbook lessons. And so we're going to go through the context, go through the points of view, and look at how that lesson is made to shift the mind, because, you know, this is, you know, what he's talking about right here. So anyway, end of tirade. So the problem we have in comprehending this is that we usually try to understand it from our reference point as bodies, but it can never be understood on that level, because our perception of ourselves as bodies is itself a choice to separate ourselves from our minds and from the truth. So our concentration should be on the process of forgiveness, which will undo the many ways in which we interfere with love's communication in our minds. A clear understanding of these quote-unquote theories will then emerge. And that's really the practice. The practice, you know, he's talking about, they're talking about forgiveness, you know, not just forgiving each other our sins and forgiving, you know, the world for all the bad things that we see, forgiving our belief that it's real, right. Forgiving, letting go of the belief that this world is real. And so, you know, if we came to the end of the year with the knowing there is no world, from doing the 365 lessons, that is, I mean, that would be everything, really.
Yeah. And it ties back to the first quote, which I'm glad you mentioned the what is questions in the last part of the workbook, because while you were talking earlier, I looked up the first quote, which was, it does not create nor really change at all. It merely looks on devastation and reminds the mind that what it sees is false. That actually is from the what is number 13, which is why I was looking for workbook lesson 13. So that's actually the correct syntax for the annotation. But I was just thinking, and it was actually the lesson 13, but it's actually the what is number 13, which is the what is a miracle, and that ties into it perfectly. And the miracle really is basically doing the Holy Spirit's curriculum, which is basically trusting our inner kindness teacher, and then with that awareness that we took with us into the dream, looking at the devastation, whether it's the devastation of the opulence of Tsarist Russia and you know the cultural connections to that, or the devastation of a state fair. You know, or anything else that we look out in this world, where if we think of it as being a limitation on the perfection that we are, and you know that there's victimhood and that there's tragedy and drama and all that kind of stuff, then we're seeing it with you know, a teacher that's not going to lead us out of the quagmire again. We just need to change teachers and look with our inner kindness teacher and see the shared interests. And that's the pragmatic way of actually applying the course and its forgiveness curriculum.
Exactly. And it comes from actually wanting peace.
Right.
It comes from actually wanting peace.
That's it.
You got to ask yourself, when you're not having peace, why is it that I don't want peace? And not feel guilty when you recognize the answer is because what is happening now is much more entertaining than peace, or much more interesting, or I'm getting a kick out of it somehow. Even if I'm being tortured, I'm getting ego is, you know, reveling in its victimhood.
Right, right.
I mean, this is, what am I getting from this? Whatever it is that's happening, what am I getting from this? And recognize that it's all based on the belief in guilt.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you should mention torture, because another thing that my family watched together, which I haven't seen in many years, was a movie called Princess Bride. And there's there's war and fighting and you know, all sorts of hand to hand combat, as well as a torture scene in there. And I was thinking, well, as you're saying that, it's like, well, that's what we call entertainment in this world is the entertainment of righteous indignation about victimhood, and whether we're the victim or the victimizer, it doesn't really matter. As long as there's a victim and as long as there's injustice, and it requires a world that where this could be possible. And of course, what our curriculum here suggests is maybe the whole premise on which the world that you've made up, that where that can be possible, is flawed, and that's a world where devastation could be possible, where there could be victims and victimizers, where there could be wickedness, sin, and evil, and like Ken Wapnick says, you know, it's just silly. It's just silly when we step back from it, look at it with our decision makers' toggle switch switched over to our teacher of compassion and kindness, and realize, that's just silly. It's just, it doesn't have to be the ego's interpretation 24/7. We could switch over to the director's cut on our DVD in the mind that shows peace instead of the special love, special hate craziness. Yeah.
Exactly. And just to remember, nothing was harmed in the making of this illusion. Nothing.
Yes.
Nothing real can be threatened, and nothing unreal exists. That to me is the most reassuring sentences in the world. It really just brings you to the point where you recognize it doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter what appears to be going on in this world. Our eternal self is safe at home, has never left,
yes,
and we are in heaven.
Yeah. Like I was joking with my brother yesterday, it says, no Nagas were harmed in the making of this Naga hide.
Those poor Nagas.
Those poor Nagas. You probably didn't see any Nagas at the state fair yesterday, but
they're
one of those oppressed animals that we hear about, but we never see, right?
They're
actually fictional, right?
And do you know now they're making a leather-like material out of mushrooms?
Oh, really?
Yes, and it really is amazing, this stuff. I don't know how they do it, but because mushrooms seem pretty flimsy to me. But
what were they smoking when they invented this, huh?
I don't know. What can I do with these? Anyway, very interesting.
Yes.
All right. Well, Bruce Rawls, next week again, we will meet on ACIM Gather. And it's just, I'm again very excited about the shift and change that's going on. You know, because for me, it allows a lot more freedom.
Good.
You know, I get a lot more freedom and really liking to be continuing to concentrate on the Course in Miracles is very, very helpful to me. And
yeah. Your workbook curriculum sounds great. And I was reminded of how much wonderful material is in Ken Wapnick's Journey Through the Workbook and the other two Journey Through the Text and Manual books that, in my mind, they're sort of his summa cum laude Opus Magnum works. Not that any of his other works are any less brilliant and revealing, but that would be a great one to draw from as you're going through the workbook. And I'm getting close to being ready to go through it again. It's just so much good stuff in there. Just as a quick reminder before we end the session that for people that might not know or haven't signed up yet or that might be interested, there's a virtual conference that's happening in October, which is coming up in less than a couple months now. In fact, I'm going to be doing my recording for it. It's basically all about relationships and how that relates to A Course in Miracles. And so I'm looking forward to assembling some thoughts about that. And I've already got a whole bunch of notes going in my head. But we'll make their way onto this half-hour video. And each person of the 24 people that are involved do a half-hour video. And then there's a questions and an answer session after that that's phone-in for the people that are listening live. But you can actually watch and listen to these video audio pairs of half hours for each presenter at any time, a year or more afterward the fact. So if you don't happen to have that weekend available, it's not a big deal. It's a virtual conference. So that's kind of one of the cool things about it. There's no travel expenses and no lodging and and transportation and airfare and that kind of stuff. But it's, if you go to acimblog.com in the upper left corner, I've got a little link to that, and that helps the affiliate income from that. If you do sign up, it's same price regardless, but that helps my income factor in the dream. So that's always appreciated.
That's always helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, and I appreciate your support, Lynn, and putting these things together every week, and everybody who listens and participates. And I know there's a tremendous amount of generosity and contributions that happen on this forum and so many others. So anyway, thank you again.
All right, and thank you. If you're interested, I'm kind of thinking maybe you'd like to help me or share with me during some of these teachings about the lessons. Because, this is my feeling on all of this is that when we join together, that synergy brings up, you think of things, I think of things, it is really, Jesus is right. This joining thing is really effective.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's a shared interest. Just like yesterday when I got my personal interest out of the way and started thinking, well, what would we all enjoy? And I thought, well, duh, the conversation yesterday about the Hermitage and everybody was interested in that. And when I, loaded up the movie and hit play, we just all really enjoyed it. And everybody seemed to get something out of it, including, there was one painting that my aunt had seen that was very moving for her, and I had similar connections. As she was talking about, it was this classic painting about the prodigal son, and I could just from the brief exposure of the camera being trained on this masterpiece as it went through the Hermitage, I was reflecting on the artist's inspiration and how we all are in this prodigal journey of the mind, and yet. Nothing happened. And I was reflecting on a commentary that I heard on the radio about the Sorcerer's Apprentice where in the Fantasia version, Mickey Mouse character, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, is all upset that the master is going to be upset, just like the father is going to be upset when the prodigal son returns. But no, it's like this great rejoicing. It's like, wow, you've come back and no harm has been done. No Nagas were sacrificed. it's all about the shared interest. And that's when we, even on the level of forum, seem to have the most fun and it becomes a happy dream. Not because the dream itself, because that's the realm of devastation, but the mind that recognizes the shared interests are what's important is what then brings us back to that peace that we never left. So anyway, thanks again, Lynn, and looking forward to our next conversation.
And me too, and we'll talk to you next Saturday.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. I love you, buddy. And
likewise.
I will send you this recording.
Looking forward to that, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.